everybody. Thanks for joining me for another Geeked on History podcast. This week, we're going to have a continuation of the Andrew Jackson podcast series, which I started last week. So this is episode 2. If you prefer to hear this in sequence, you may want to go back and listen to the first episode so you can get an idea of where we're at. But if you don't feel like doing that, then I'll give you a quick recap right now. So in the previous episode, we went into the beginnings of this infamous, very notable man, Andrew Jackson. And his history is not as clear in some parts as it is in others. But we do know that this man came from very humble beginnings. He came from a family that had already been torn apart before he was born. And essentially, he's lost all of his loved ones by the time that he turns 14 years old. He's been heavily involved in the legal system. He's fought in the Revolutionary War as a courier. He's become one of the early figures in frontier justice. And he's been taking on early congressional roles as well. So we're starting to see the early years of Andrew Jackson being formative for his time later as a statesman and other positions that he would have in the legal system as well. So you can already see that he's getting experience in two of the three branches of government that we experience today, the judicial branch and the legislative branch. So he's already had tours in both of those branches. And today we're going to start to talk about how he got experience in that third branch, in the executive branch. So everything we've talked about up until now has been before the War of 1812. And if you know absolutely anything about Andrew Jackson, then you probably know about his contributions during the War of 1812. This is where he really starts to pick up fame and fortune. So we're going to kick it off in 1801. 1801 is when Andrew Jackson is appointed to be a colonel in the Tennessee militia. Militias were basically what the early United States had to offer in terms of defense. We didn't really believe in a standing army at that point. We'd kind of seen what a standing army can cause countries to do when we compare it to what Great Britain did, where they would take these standing armies and basically try and find new wars to fight. That goes back to that old saying, if you have a hammer, then everything's a nail. That's kind of how early America viewed this idea of having a standing army that is always on commission. That idea of, well, if you're going to pay for it, then you might as well use it, right? Why not build empires? The United States, during its early period, was not about building empires at all. It was very against that whole idea. So their solution to that was to use militias instead. Small groups of people that were armed, that could be called up to defend whatever territory they needed to, in very short notice, against any kind of adversary whatsoever. So true to form, Andrew Jackson takes this posting as a colonel in 1801, and by 1802, he's a general. So if you're familiar with the structure of the U.S. military, you'll understand that that's a pretty big jump to have happen in just a year's time. It's almost unprecedented. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody in peacetime that made that kind of jump as quickly as Andrew Jackson did. But again, this may just go back to that whole idea of they didn't have that many experienced people around in Tennessee at that time. So if you've got a colonel who's really proving himself, maybe he deserves to be promoted to general because there's just not anybody else that's good for the job. One of the biggest problems that the early United States had, which we kind of don't really think about anymore, was this problem of defense. Our early years were spent trying to figure out how we could expand the country and defend it all at the same time. And this landmass at that time was pretty much free for the taking. And not just to the colonists or the early Americans either. It was up for grabs for anybody that was in that territory and could occupy it. So France was one of these major players in this area. Spain was a pretty major player, although their candle was starting to fade a little bit. You even had countries like Germany and Russia trying to grab land and protect it as quickly as they could in this era. But apart from the nation-state-sponsored land grabs that were happening at this time, we also had this major, major issue with the Native Americans. This was their national defense moment. This was do or die for the Native Americans, and they were going to do everything that they could in order to fight for their homes, even if it meant taking on an enemy with vastly superior technologies. They were also making alliances with other countries as well, most famously with the French, but there were others. And what you see from these early Native American insurrections, if you want to call it that, is a struggle internally and amongst all these various tribes in order to just get along so that they could ward off these invaders, as they saw it. So throughout the entire century of the 1800s, you see a number of different native leaders coming out of the fold in order to just try and get people to get along. Some of them were more successful than others. But one of the most notable folks to ever come out of this era for the Native Americans was a man that went by the name of Tecumseh. Tecumseh's one of these guys that rivals the notoriety of Andrew Jackson, in fact. Even if you don't know much about history, you've probably heard his name at some point. He was a very well-respected tribe leader within his own tribe, between other tribes, and even with his enemies, the early Americans. The words courage and bravery don't even begin to sum up Tecumseh's contributions to the defense of the native lands. You also see figures in American history later on that co-opt his name, like William Tecumseh Sherman. So Tecumseh's ultimate goal was to protect the Northern Ohio Territory from any further colonization by the early Americans. One of the ways that he planned to achieve that was by unifying the native tribes in the northwest area of the United States. Another way that he planned to help protect the Northern Ohio area was by encouraging the Red Stick Creek natives from northern Alabama and Georgia to fight back against settlement in their areas. Now, what you get out of this native defense of their own territories are a lot of very small skirmishes. And what they're doing is they're attacking settlements. They're not really attacking town centers or anything like that. Their goal was to try and stop the settlements before they had a chance to really grow. So you had a lot of these smaller battles where they would kill off a settlement or the settlement would defend itself, and then the natives would move on or regroup and then try and hit more settlements as they went along. I think it was pretty well understood by the natives that they really didn't have the kinds of numbers or technology to conduct a full-on assault on any of these major cities that were well defended, so their attack had to be a little bit different. However, that didn't mean that they never tried to attack any major settlements. And one of these instances that you have is the Fort Mims Massacre. Now, when you say massacre in terms of a historical event, especially an early historical event in the United States like this one, you can be pretty sure that there was a lot of bloodshed. But another kind of note that you can make on that is that whenever something is called a massacre, it's usually called a massacre by the people that were being massacred. So the massacre happened on August 30th, 1813, and it happened during a conflict that we call the Creek War. Now, the Creek War was one of these wars that we had against the natives. It was much larger in terms of scale than most of the other smaller skirmishes that I had talked about before. The Creek War, or it's sometimes called the Red Stick War, started as a civil war within the Creek tribe. Now, one other thing to kind of keep in mind as we go through this podcast is that the Native American, early American relationship was not always as black and white as you might think. You did not squarely have all of the natives on one side and all of the early Americans on the other. It did not always work out that way. Tribes being what they were, and allegiances being what they were, oftentimes ended up in sort of a cross-pollination of objectives, where these different parties would have to cooperate in order to get what they wanted to get done. And the Creek War is a perfect example of what I'm talking about here. So on one side, you have the Red Stick Creek natives, who were very, very, very opposed to the idea of assimilation with the early Americans. They were staunchly against this idea that the early Americans were going to sweep through and take up all this land. They wanted to fight until the death. And on the other side of this conflict, you have the early United States, the Lower Creeks, the Cherokee, and the Choctaw. So you have a sort of four-group coalition to try and fight against the Red Sticks in order to push further into these native lands. And another sort of interesting thing that you see going on here, genetically, is that the Europeans have been in the North American continent in these native lands for a few hundred years by this time. And so you actually start to see mixed races coming out of this time, where Europeans interbred with natives and vice versa. And so some of these native figures actually have European names. So the commanders on the U.S. Native American coalition side, they were mainly led by early American leaders, Andrew Jackson being one of them, John Coffey, William McIntosh. But on the other side, you have a man named William Weatherford and another man named Peter McQueen. So you can kind of see it's not quite as clear-cut as you might have thought. The genetics is getting a little bit muddled, but the ideology that some of these folks are fighting for hasn't really changed for a couple hundred years. So we were talking about Fort Mims, so let's go back to that. Fort Mims was actually located about 35 miles north of what we call Mobile, Alabama today. It was a pretty well-fortified outpost, the blockade, and it was defended by 255 soldiers. It was a mixture of Tennessee militia and some other volunteer forces that just happened to have guns. And by the time the Fort Mims massacre had happened, you already had some smaller engagements in the Creek War that had led up to this point. The blood was starting to boil, and it was just about to boil over. One of the major things that happens at this time that comes up a little bit later, just before the Fort Mims massacre, and one of these things that happens just before the Fort Mims massacre, is that early American spies have found out that Peter McQueen's Red Stick Indians are getting help from the new Spanish governor in Pensacola, Florida. They were given food, supplies, and weapons, all thanks to the new Spanish governor. Another thing worth noting is that Florida at this time still belonged to the Spanish. They weren't defending it very well, but it was still technically Spanish territory. So, to respond to this problem, some militiamen were sent down, and what we call the Battle of Burnt Corn happened in July of 1813, where the Creek forces were basically enjoying lunch, and they were ambushed by these militiamen. About 10 or 12 Red Stick natives were killed, but it wasn't really a major battle. But what it did do was it kicked off the Creek War. So essentially, as payback for the Battle of Burnt Corn, the Red Stick leaders decide that they're going to attack Fort Mims. And what you see happen at Fort Mims is absolutely what we would define squarely as a massacre. The Red Sticks had been able to supply 750 to 1,000 warriors in order to fight in this conflict, and the defense of Fort Mims lied on the shoulders of 255 soldiers. I may have already said that, but just to give you an idea of the forces, the comparison of the forces here, it was astounding. Now, we hear stories like the Alamo, where you had a few defenders and a massive army trying to take over an installation, but that was the exception to the rule. What would happen at Fort Mims would not be a prelude to what would later happen at the Alamo. And Fort Mims would see 517 people killed or captured, and the outpost severely damaged. And that number, the 517 total, included women and children. Now, any military conflict is really just a series of attack and counterattack. And Andrew Jackson, being one of these major leaders in the militia that would see most of the fighting during the Creek War, the Tennessee Militia, would have his revenge for Fort Mims during the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. Now, I was talking to a friend before I started working on this podcast, kind of in the middle of my putting together the outline and the content, and I asked him this question that I still don't really have an answer to. I asked him, what do you call somebody who commands legends? Do you call him a super legend? I don't really have an answer to that, but we should have an answer to that, because that's exactly what Andrew Jackson was at this time. Two of the most famous people to come out of this early American time period were actually in the Tennessee militia at this time, being commanded by Andrew Jackson. Those two men, I'm sure you've heard their names, are Sam Houston and none other than Davy Crockett. Davy Crockett would go on to have his own TV show. Andrew Jackson would not. But that doesn't change the fact that Andrew Jackson basically told Davy Crockett what to do. So what do you call that kind of leader? Another little side fact to bring up here is that Davy Crockett actually joined up because of the Fort Mims massacre. That was what inspired him to join the Tennessee militia and take on this enlistment under Andrew Jackson. And so one of the first things that Davy Crockett would do as his tenure under Andrew Jackson as an enlisted officer was participate in the retributive attack on an Indian village called the Massacre at Tallulahatchie. So this Creek War would go on officially for about a year, and many historians consider the Creek War to be a part of the War of 1812, but it really deserves its own category, its own separate recognition. But in any event, the Creek War would end with the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. So Jackson starts sweeping up these military honors, having defeated the Red Sticks in battle, and after the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, he would be appointed Major General. The Creek natives would actually even give him a nickname, Jackson Old and Fierce. So one of the reasons that historians consider the Creek War and the War of 1812 to be basically the same thing is because they kind of bleed into each other. And so finally, when Andrew Jackson wins his victory over the Red Stick Creeks, he goes straight back into his other rivalry that he has against the British. This part of Andrew Jackson's life doesn't necessarily need an introduction. Many of you guys probably already know about this, but this is the Battle of New Orleans, so I'm going to get into this because it's a very important piece of the story. So we're going to skip ahead a couple years between the ending of the Creek War and the Battle of New Orleans, so we're going to go back to January 8th of 1815. And so Andrew Jackson's put in command of defending the city of New Orleans, the entire city, And this is a very important city at this time because it's one of the furthest west cities in the United States that's really been settled to the point that New Orleans has. The soldiers in particular in this battle liked Andrew Jackson, but they thought he was pretty strict. And he was. He was a pretty strict leader. And it was about this time that he actually earned another nickname, but this time with his own soldiers. His soldiers would say that he was tough as old hickory. And so later during his campaigns for president, he would be called Old Hickory. It was kind of a nickname that stuck with him for the rest of his life, actually. So because the Battle of New Orleans, I think, is so well known, I'm only going to get into this one a little bit. So Jackson basically takes 5,000 soldiers and defeats a British force of 7,500 soldiers. The British had upwards of 2,000 casualties for that battle and almost 300 people dead. On the flip side of that, the Americans had 71 casualties and only lost 13 people in the end. So that you could get an idea just by those numbers of why this was such an important battle and why this actually gave Andrew Jackson so much popularity. So Jackson goes from fighting the British now. He's defeated the Native Americans in a big way. He's defeated the British, which this, by the way, the Battle of New Orleans is basically the last hurrah for the War of 1812. This is what really solidifies the victory on the part of the early United States against the British and finally forces that conflict to come to an end. Now, the whole War of 1812 is fodder for another podcast. There's just so much to that, and I think that there's so many misunderstandings that Americans in particular have about that war that's on my list to do. That's on my list of history topics to cover, so I'm going to let that one sit a little bit, but just understand that that war was a very strange war, very significant, but very, very strange. Not one that the United States should be proud of, by the way. But having won these victories against two foreign adversaries, essentially, Andrew Jackson then turns his gaze to another part of the country. So we skip ahead a couple more years to the year 1817. And Jackson is tasked by President James Monroe to take on a new campaign, but this time into the Florida Territory. Now, we got into this a little bit just a few minutes ago. Why would the early United States have any interest whatsoever in the Florida Territory? So it's being held by the Spanish at this time, and we already have the information that the new governor of the Florida Territory is starting to help aid these fighters against the settlements that are kind of popping up all over the country. So this is a problem that needs to be dealt with, and the way that it's decided that it will be dealt with by President Monroe is with military action. So Monroe taps Jackson to go into the Florida Territory and put an end to this whole helping the natives thing, and there's also this sort of side problem of slaves from the southern territories making their way into the Florida Territory and essentially leaving the country. So, like I said, the Florida Territory is its own territory that belongs to Spain at this point. So it's a border. It's a foreign border that slaves can flee across and find freedom. And this is a problem for an early president like James Monroe. So it's decided that Jackson is going to take a contingent of men into Florida and just basically invade that territory. Now, this was a pretty easy campaign for Jackson because there actually wasn't a garrison of Spanish troops in the Florida Territory that could have opposed him at that time. You see, the Spanish influence over the North American continent, and to some degree the South American continent, but more so pronounced in the North American continent, was starting to wane in a really big way. They just didn't have the military force that was required in order to protect all of this territory. So when Andrew Jackson gets there, he just takes the place over. He just walks through the front door, basically. Now, this does not make Spain happy at all. They see it as a foreign military has just invaded their territory, and they are very upset over this. They demand that Andrew Jackson be punished accordingly for his actions, and the Secretary of State at that time, it was John Quincy Adams, defended Jackson by saying this to the Spanish. Spain must immediately decide whether to place a force in Florida adequate at once to the protection of her territory, or cede to the United States a province, of which she retains nothing but nominal possession, but which is, in fact, a post of annoyance to them. The translation of this is, look, either protect your land claims, or just give it to us. Now, Spain knowing better than to try and get into a conflict with the early United States that they really weren't prepared to do, decided it would really just be best to just give over this land. And that's exactly what they do in 1819 with the Adams-Onis Treaty. Now, for his trouble, Jackson was named military governor and served from March 10th of 1821 to December 31st of 1821. So it wasn't a very long appointment, but he was already there, and Florida hadn't really been folded into the United States yet, so it kind of made sense to just kind of put him in charge in the interim. So here we are at 1821, and Andrew Jackson is middle-aged, but he's just now starting to hit his stride. He had all this political and judicial experience before, but now he's added this huge military record full of victories to his playlist. And we're going to see how he takes all of this fame that he's just gained, because his victory during the Battle of New Orleans and all of his achievements during the Creek War are all going to come back, and people know him now over this. This is something that he's famous for. So we're going to see him take all of this newfound power and fame, wrap it all up, and try and take it down the campaign trail. And we're going to pick up right there on our next podcast. Thanks again for listening to this part two of the Andrew Jackson story. I hope you all are enjoying it so far. And I can feel you all are really excited to see where he goes from here and what exactly happens with him. I know that you're just on pins and needles. We don't know if he's going to actually win the presidency or if he's even going to campaign, but we're going to find out. And I just can't wait for it. I'm just busting at the seams to really to get down this road and see what happens at the end. But as usual, if you guys have any comments or questions or you want to talk about this at all, feel free to email me at nick@geekedonhistory.com or feel free to join us at the website at geekedonhistory.com. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please don't forget to subscribe and to rate it. And if you have friends that are into history, let them know too. Thanks again for listening, and you all stay geeky.